Great. Cool. Hi. Yeah, thanks so much for joining today. I'm Michael Pashkovich. I'm a research fellow in the Department of Zoology, and I'm in the Insect Ecology Group in the University Museum of Zoology. And today I'm going to be talking about my research and some of our group's research into more sustainable agricultural practices in oil palm. I had COVID a couple of weeks ago, and I still have a residual cough, so excuse me if I'm coughing some throughout. Just as a brief overview of what I'm going to be talking about, in case you're unfamiliar with oil palm as a crop, I'll just give a quick intro as to what it is and why we care about it. I am then going to go over two research projects that I've been associated with in Indonesia and industrial oil palm plantations to investigate how management of these plantations affects the overall ecosystem. And then what I want to do is to provide a brief overview of a project I've started this year in Liberia and West Africa to study how the establishment of new oil palm plantations affects ecosystems in the region. So again, I'm assuming that people are familiar with oil palm as a crop, but if not, I'll give a quick overview. And this photo here is reminiscent of a very typical oil palm plantation. So it's often grown as a monoculture, meaning it's the only crop that's grown, and it's grown with very intensive management. So here, for instance, we see that quite a lot of herbicides have been applied in order to kill off the understory vegetation. It's very likely that there's going to be many pesticides applied, and also heavy application of fertilizers in order to help the crop grow. Now, the reason why we grow oil palm is that if you look where those palm trunks meet the fronds, we see these red conglomerate fruits. And within these fruits are two different types of oil, palm oil and palm kernel oil. And these are the products of oil palm as a crop and why we grow it. My guess is that most of what you hear around oil palm is negative. And so I always like to ask, well, why is oil palm so controversial? And to provide some context for that. In many ways, oil palm is this incredible crop. So it's very profitable. It's grown across the tropics, and it's grown predominantly in low-income and lower middle-income economies. So it provides a huge economic resource both to individuals and countries in these regions. Additionally, it's the highest yielding vegetable oil crop globally. And what I mean by that is that in comparison to alternative vegetable oil crops, such as soybean or sunflower or oilseed rape, you get 4 to 10 times as much oil per hectare of land from oil palm. And so you get tons of oil out of it, relative to the amount of resource that you put in, meaning that it's very productive. Lastly, it's quite a versatile oil as well. So it can be used for many different purposes, ranging from food products to cosmetics to even biodiesel. And so we can do a lot with this oil once we actually have it produced. The reason, though, why oil palm is so controversial, for the most part, is because of its ecological impacts. So, as I said, is that oil palm is grown in tropical countries. And what this means is that the expansion of the crop has occurred at the expense of native habitat, and specifically a lot of rainforest. So what you see here is an industrial oil palm plantation in Malaysia, and you see that most of it's oil palm, and then there's a small fragment of rainforest that remains. And otherwise, this would have covered the entire landscape. Now, of course, when you turn rainforest into agriculture, a number of different ecological processes occur. So on the one hand, what you have happen immediately is you get lower levels of vegetation complexity and diversity as you turn a rainforest into an oil palm plantation. So you can see here on the schematic on the left, you have much greater variation in canopy height, much greater variation in density towards the ground, and the number and types of species that are present in this rainforest in comparison to the monoculture oil palm plantation. This change in vegetation complexity and diversity also corresponds to changes in microclimate. And specifically, what happens is that in relative to rainforest, oil palm plantations are hotter and drier across the day. So on these two plots here, on the left is temperature, on the right is VPD, so measure of dryness, is that the red line is oil palm and the green line is rainforest. So we can see hotter and drier plantations. Now, of course, when you change the plant and the microclimate communities, what you're going to have is a corresponding impact on biodiversity. And to show what that looks like across a broad range of taxonomic groups, I'm referencing this plot from William and Foster and colleagues. And the way to interpret this plot is that on the x-axis is abundance, so the number of individuals, and on the y-axis is the number of species or species richness. And each of these arrows corresponds to a different taxonomic group. And the arrow starts at the biodiversity recorded in rainforest, and the head of the arrow is the biodiversity recorded in an oil palm plantation. And the mean trend across these different arrows is pointing towards the downward left, so lower biodiversity in oil palm. And then this is true for a range of groups, including ones that are particularly important towards conservation campaigns and cultural importance, such as orangutans in Southeast Asia and chimpanzees in West Africa. Now, given the ecological impact of establishing oil palm plantations, there have been kind of two main strategies put forward in order to combat this. So the first of these are widespread boycotts of palm oil. And if you're not familiar with what's on your screen, this is from an advert that ran from the supermarket chain Iceland, I think in 2019 it was, where effectively it told the story of a little girl who gets visited by an orangutan, and the orangutan is sad because his homeland has been destroyed by an oil palm plantation. Iceland announced that they were boycotting all palm oil products, and they ended up not doing that actually. But this echoes though a lot of different campaigns to boycott palm oil. Now, deforestation is bad. It absolutely shouldn't be happening. But one of the issues with this approach towards tackling the ecological impacts of oil palm establishment is that it is likely to displace the issue. And what I mean by that is that the world needs vegetable oil. It's important to global food security. And so if you're not producing it in oil palm, it means that the demand for that oil is going to come from a different crop. And given that oil palm is the most productive vegetable oil crop worldwide, it means that we might end up having more land to produce the same amount of oil, therefore increasing or at least equaling the threat to biodiversity. Now, an alternative strategy is to look for changes within oil palm management. So rather than stopping production, looking for ways to improve the way in which oil palm is produced, in order to create more sustainable and environmentally less harmful, but still high-yielding oil palm systems. And this is where my research predominantly falls, is looking at how management affects these agroecosystems. The ecological theory behind this is that generally there's a positive relationship between the number of species in an ecosystem and productivity. So in this case, we can think about this in terms of crop yields for productivity. In oil palm, this has been shown to be the case. So for instance, Anne Girard and colleagues did a study wherein they grew oil palm with enrichment planting of rainforest trees around the palms, and they compared yields within these enriched sites to those in adjacent oil palm monocultures, and they found that the enriched sites had higher yields. So again, just to sort of recap now as I move from an introduction into my own research, is that the mechanism for my research is to see how changes in oil palm management translate into enhanced ecological complexity, therefore improving the delivery of key ecosystem services, such as pollination or pest control or decomposition, therefore leading to more sustainable but still high-yielding oil palm systems. Right, and today I'm going to particularly talk about my research into two strategies for growing oil palm. The first of these is looking at what happens when you replant oil palm at the end of its commercial life cycle. And the second one that I'm going to be talking about is looking at what happens when you change the amount of herbicides that you apply within plantations, therefore affecting understory vegetation diversity and complexity. My research into these strategies have occurred in industrial oil palm plantations in Sumatra, Indonesia. So these are large-scale oil palm plantations. You could drive for about 2 hours and see nothing other than oil palm that are owned by a large-scale corporation. And this one is Indonesian, owned by a parent company in Singapore. And these plantations are part of the research and development arm. So the company that we work directly with is called Smartree. Their parent company is called Golden Agri Resources, which you might be familiar with. The purpose of these plantations in Sumatra here is purely to investigate how different management strategies can increase oil palm yields and also sustainability. So this is work done hand in hand with the oil palm industry. My research focuses on arthropods, which include groups like insects and arachnids. And the reason for this is that arthropods are incredibly abundant in oil palm, but also they're very important towards the functioning of this agricultural system. So this plot here is by work done by Claudia Dislick, who looked at what are some different ecosystem functions that occur within oil palm plantations and what taxonomic groups contribute towards those functions. And arthropods contribute towards the majority of these. And even some of these other ones, they contribute indirectly too. So they're incredibly functionally important and therefore affect these crop yields. And I just want to say that, so I study arthropods at a whole ecosystem level. So in the oil palm canopy, in the understory vegetation and on the ground. And I additionally, spiders are what my research expertise is really in as well. So aside from looking at the whole community at more of an overview order level, I also do focused surveys on spiders, which has really led to me spending several months of my life staring down microscopes at spider sex organs. So that's part of my research too. Right, so let's talk about replanting. Oil palm commercially is about a 20 to 30 year old crop. So in the wild, it can grow much longer than this. But what happens though after about 20 to 30 years in plantations is that yields start to decline. And so therefore it becomes more profitable over time to replant these mature oil palms with young palms. If you've never sort of walked through a mature oil palm plantation, or again, if you haven't seen many photos of them, this is very reminiscent. You can see that it's mostly a closed canopy. There are epiphytes along the trunks, and there's sort of a dense understory vegetation layer that you can see here as well, aside from sort of these chopped up palms in the foreground. And when you walk through one of these plantations, it almost feels a bit forest-like. So you hear birds calling, there are insects flying around. Of course, the difference is that when you look up, you don't see a variety of different trees, you instead just see oil palms. And when these industrial plantations are replanted, one strategy for doing this is to drive a bulldozer through it. I'll turn off my... and essentially knock down these palms. And you can imagine that if you were an insect or if you were a bird inhabiting one of these palms, that's going to be quite the day for you. And then given that they're doing this across vast landscapes, it could have a severe impact on these ecosystems. This hasn't though really been studied too much in terms of what are the impacts of these replanting events, despite the fact that replanting is occurring at a grand scale across plantations across Southeast Asia at the moment. So we were studying what happens when this occurs. And to do this, we conducted a space for time experimental design, wherein we sampled mature first generation oil palm plantations that had never before been replanted, and then also replanted oil palm ages 1, 3, and 8. So that 8-year-old growing up into the mature second generation. And just to drive that home one more time, because you'll be seeing these images on the next coming slides, is that this green block is first generation, never before been replanted. And then the second generation is 1 year, 3 year, and 8 year in yellow, pink, and blue. And let's talk about some findings. So shown here are three box plots. On the x-axis are those different oil palm ages that I just mentioned. And on the y-axis is the abundance of insects per sample in three different microhabitats. So on the ground, in the understory, and in the canopy. Surprisingly, what we found is that actually there were no significant differences in the total abundance of arthropods across this range in any of our microhabitats. We did find some differences in the order level composition in these three different microhabitats, but we particularly though also found some taxonomic specific trends. And just to give you a picture of what that might look like, I'm going to turn to spiders, so my research taxonomic group. And what you're seeing here on this plot is the number of spiders per 100 meters across our different study sites. And you'll see that there's a short-term decline a year after replanting in the number of spiders. And this also corresponds towards the number of spider species. There's the species richness now on this bottom plot. And also changes in spider community composition. So the relative abundance of different species. The way you can interpret this by plot here is that these polygons correspond to the different ages of oil palm still. So green being mature, yellow, pink, and blue being 1, 3, and 8 years. And the further apart those polygons are from each other, the more dissimilar the spider communities are. Now, the implication of this finding is that after replanting, there's a decline in these key predators of oil palm pests. And so what that means then is that there might be a need to change up management in young oil palm plantations to try and boost predator numbers in order to mitigate the potential impacts of these pest species. So spiders are only predators. They will always be conferring pest control services and not conferring some other sort of function. And so having low numbers of them indicates a potential decline in pest management services. Right, so that's enough about replanting. I'm now going to talk about application of herbicides in order to change understory vegetation complexity in oil palm. This photo here is something that's quite typical to see in industrial oil palm plantations. And what's happening here is that this is an estate worker. He has sort of a vat of herbicide and water mixture on his back. And then he's walking through the plantation and blitzing the understory vegetation with this mixture. The reason for this is that some oil palm managers argue that the understory vegetation competes with the palms for key growth resources, such as water and nutrients in the soil. On the other hand, though, it could be that this understory vegetation is really valuable habitat for a wide array of biodiversity within plantations that could confer ecosystem services that benefit palm oil yields. And so sort of the net effect of this understory vegetation has been a bit unclear. And so our research group here in Cambridge, along with our colleagues in Indonesia, went about to sort of see what might be the effects of altering herbicide application and therefore understory vegetation complexity within plantations. And basically the spectrum of understory vegetation management that you would find in oil palm is completely killing all understory vegetation by blitzing it with herbicides. Applying herbicides only in key areas, such as along harvesting paths, as well as around the actual oil palms, therefore creating sort of a medium amount of understory vegetation, or not applying herbicides at all and allowing understory vegetation to grow up abundantly and basically restore itself passively. Now, to look at the impacts of these three different potential strategies for understory vegetation management, we implemented a large-scale long-term before-after control impact experiment. And what I mean by that is that we sampled study plots that were basically all following a business-as-usual management practice. So what the oil palm industry, whom we collaborate with, how they manage their practices on a day-to-day basis. That's what you see on the top here. Then we implemented experimental treatments to look at what happens when you blitz all of the understory vegetation, so that's our reduced treatment. When you don't change your management, so you keep on doing business as usual, that's our normal, or if you stop applying herbicides entirely and allow vegetation to restore passively, which is our enhanced. And you can compare between those two time points to understand what's the effects of these treatments on the oil palm ecosystem. And again, just to give you sort of the visual as to what those treatments look like on the ground, this is our reduced, normal, and enhanced treatment. We've gone ahead and we've observed the effects of these different treatments on a whole variety of different attributes of the oil palm ecosystem. So ranging from the canopy down into the soil. But I'm just going to talk about a particular part of that project that I've been associated with, which is what's the effects of these management practices on these spiders. And this was work that was started actually by Dakota Spear, a former MPhil student in our research group. What we did is that we looked at spiders both living in the oil palm canopy and on the ground in order to see whether there were any changes in their biodiversity following the implementation of our treatments. And surprisingly, what we found is that even though going from our before to our after treatment implementation, we had fewer spiders, this was a consistent decline across our treatments, indicating that treatment wasn't the cause of this effect. The same thing occurs when we look at the number of spider species. So here you're now seeing richness on that y-axis. So a decline in species over time, but not differing across treatments, therefore indicating another effect at play. Of course, if I were you, what I would be thinking was, well, that makes quite a lot of sense. These are spiders up in the canopy. Presumably, they're far away from the ground. Therefore, the understory vegetation doesn't matter too much to them. So we also looked at spiders on the ground, and what we found, though, was the same effect. So there were no changes in the abundance of these spiders or changes in their species richness. And what this indicates is that these spiders are incredibly robust to changes in understory vegetation management. And this is actually a bit of a good news story in that it indicates that the pest control services provided by these spiders are going to be robust in oil palm to changes in vegetation management. On the other hand, it's less of a good news story in that it indicates that if you wanted to increase the biodiversity of spiders in oil palm, you would need much more active methods of understory vegetation management to promote their biodiversity. So perhaps actively seeding for different understories, in oil palm plantations. Of course, the other thing you could be thinking is that our experiment simply didn't work. So I'm going to present some results on plants done by Sarah Luke just to show that actually in our reduced treatment, we did lower the number of understory species. And this also applies to coverage. Or you might also be thinking that spiders are a particularly robust taxa. So maybe it's simply that they don't care about the understory, but other things do. So this was work done by Millie Hood that showed a similar effect in ants as well. Taken together, and I won't show you any more plots from this project, but our findings from this experiment show that application of herbicides has taxonomic-specific effects on biodiversity, which corresponds to context-dependent effects on ecosystem processes and yields. Now, in the last part of my talk now, I just want to give a brief overview of some new research that I'm conducting in West Africa, and specifically in Liberia. If you're not familiar with Liberia, this is where it is located. A really quick rundown of Liberia's recent history is that at the end of the 1980s, Liberia went into civil war, and this persisted throughout the 90s and ended in the early 2000s. There were a number of course, different consequences of the civil war, but one of them is that whereas surrounding countries in the region, such as Guinea and Côte d'Ivoire, experienced heavy deforestation throughout the 80s, 90s, and 2000s, owing to foreign development projects and large-scale land use change to promote agricultural development. This did not occur in Liberia because the country was in war. And so today, Liberia is the most densely forested country in West Africa. And it's a really interesting place to be able to study what a natural West African rainforest ecosystem looks like. What's challenging, though, is that now Liberia has been in more than 15 years of peace, which of course is great for so many different reasons. But one of sort of the unintended consequences, I guess, of that as well is that it's starting to pick up in terms of its large-scale land use change to promote agricultural development or mining activities or timber activities. So the protected ecosystems in this region, that have largely been untouched for the last few decades are quickly being threatened. Another consequence of the wars is that it meant that researchers weren't doing ecological studies in Liberia for quite some time. And just to give you a picture of what that might look like, is this was a recent review of where ant biodiversity is understudied around the world. And anywhere with that hashed pattern is an area where we don't know much about ants. I work in the southeast of Liberia. That entire region, is hashed. And broadly speaking, we don't know about much about baseline biodiversity data in this region, other than for mammals, reptiles, and birds. In the southeast, there are predominantly three different habitats. So you have rainforest, You have oil palm plantation, which here you can see from satellite view. So the left-hand side of this plot in dark green is the rainforest. And then you can see the blocks of oil palm that cut through it. And also local people practice shifting agriculture. And so what they do is that every year they burn down about 1 hectare of land and they plant cassava where this rainforest used to be. And the idea is that the nutrients in the soil are only rich enough for 1 year of harvesting. So they shift to the adjacent plot of land or somewhere else in every single year. And so we wanted to know what is the difference in the ecosystems between these three land uses in this region. So we set up a network of study plots in March 2022. And just to give you an idea here is that the purple is rainforest, the red is industrial oil palm plantation, and the yellow is these community agriculture plots, or what we call country palm. And these areas are known to have rich biodiversity. So in terms of their bats, their mammal population, so these are cane rats, which actually are native, but they're viewed as a pest in community agricultural plots. Their termites, their ants, and again, their birds, such as this hornbill shown here. And I'm not going to go into great depth because it's still early days for the findings of this project, but our analyses of canopy cover show that logically, when you turn a rainforest into an agricultural system, you open up the canopy, and that makes quite a lot of sense. And focused studies on spiders, though, have shown that this isn't necessarily an overall bad thing, though, for the ecosystem. So, for instance, the biodiversity of large web-building spiders actually increases in these industrial oil palm plantations. So as you open up the ecosystem, it's a more open landscape. There's more space for these spiders to build their webs. Many of them are generalist predators, and so they actually thrive in it. And so taken all together, what this means is that there are varying impacts of this land use change on the ecosystems, and we plan to survey the whole ecosystem over the next few years. And I figured I'd just show off some of these beautiful spiders that we've sampled back in March. This is Castrocantha crevispina. This is a genus found across the tropics and subtropics, photographed by Matthew Hendren. This is a male Araneata. You can see the incredibly complex male palps in this top right photo. And given that Liberia has had few ecological studies over the last few decades, we're getting quite exciting findings in terms of new species or species that we wouldn't expect to find in the region. And so this is a spider in the genus Mangora. They're known for these beautiful feathery hairs along their tibia. And this is from a scanning electron microscope view, and quite sure this is a new species. So we're continuing to do these baseline biodiversity surveys here to inform future management experiments. Right, so thank you so much for listening. A huge thanks to my collaborators in Cambridge and also in Indonesia and in Liberia. And I'm happy to take any questions that you might have. Cheers.
Thank you so much, Michael. That was amazing. I would just encourage people to turn their videos on if you can bear it, so that we can see everybody while we're having questions. And I think there was a question, Paul Lane, I think you were wanting to ask a question.
No, not at all. I was just...
you were applauding.
Applauding like that, yeah.
Sorry.
I may have a question, but I'll wait until other people have spoken. Yeah.
Can I invite people to put their hands up if they have questions, or if you prefer to type it in the chat, I can read it out. Any questions at all? Perhaps if you do have a question, Paul.
Maybe. I may have one. Sorry, I don't know if you can see me.
Yes, I can see you.
Thanks, Michael. That was very interesting. I work quite a bit on the same type of environments, but in Borneo and Sabah. I'm more interested in the rainforest than the plantation, but of course, because of the massive extension of plantation everywhere, that's something that that we have been looking into as well, more from the perspective of the use of and the impact it has on vertebrates like monitor lizards, flat-headed cats, and that type of thing. But of course, I've been interested also in the inverts over there. And I was just wondering, where you have any knowledge about any similarities there are between practices by Malaysians or in Borneo, northern Borneo, respect to where you have been, because I've seen also a mixture of, it's actually when I look at the plantation, I see up to three things. I see like some plantations do actually remove all those plants that grow on the ground, I have heard all sorts of stuff, including what you suggested as reasons why to have it removed, including actually an aesthetic value of having it removed. Or to say actually to have it removed so you don't have reticulated pythons waiting for you when you're walking there. I've seen also plantations where they leave it. That's absolutely no problem. I think they're more like traditional plantation owners, like proper, you know, people from the site. They own the plantations that they just know it doesn't make a difference. They don't care. They're not the big massive companies. And I've also seen that in some parts of Malaysia, there seems to be that there's a type of creeper that is actually covering plantations when they're too old. And they seem to be not be doing much about it, though, which we not consistent with the fact of them wanting to clear the ground to not have plants competing with that. So do you have any knowledge about it or anything you can compare there?
Sure. So so definitely those three strategies. So for instance, in the plantations which I worked in Indonesia, they do plant a cover crop, actually. It's a nitrogen-fixing legume. That's planted right after the new palms go in, and it does completely cover the ground, and basically it dies out whenever the canopy starts.
Okay, so that's the purpose. Okay.
Yeah, definitely. And in addition to what you said, I know as well is that I think it's probably the studies I know about it are from Malaysia, but where they're actually also practicing polyculture farmings as well. I know Bajul Azhar has done quite a lot of work looking at what's the impacts of these polyculture farms. The one thing I'll add to that is that one of the interesting things that I found in Liberia is, so the large scale oil palm companies operating in Liberia, they're Southeast Asian owned. So right now, the company that I work with is owned by Golden Agri Resources. The other large scale venture in the country was Sime Darby, although they've given up. and they've essentially tried to hand stamp Southeast Asian management practices onto Liberia. And it's not working out as well as what it does in Southeast Asia, of course. It's a different landscape. Importantly, it's really different people and culture.
Oh yeah.
And so it hasn't rolled out, I think, quite as smoothly as what it was thought. And the companies now are trying to rethink how they can manage these plantations more, taking into local contexts. Yeah.
If I may follow that up, then have you noticed anything with respect to continuity of productivity with palm oils? Yeah, because I do know in Sabah, you do have to have what you have also in some ways in South America and Central America, you have like a typical thing, you just cut down the forest, they don't do it any longer, but they plant, they put the palms, of course, it's about 7 years and they start to become productive. They start producing things, that kind of works well for 6-7 years, and then is when they start putting all these fertilizer stuff in the ground. And in some cases, I've seen that they also apply insecticides and various other things, but that seems to be not immediate from the beginning, but just maybe it's about around 12 years when I think they have been having 5-6 years of productivity. Do you see that also in Africa?
So the farms I was working in, in Liberia, they were all at least 6 years old, so they were productive. And the thing there is that fertilizer is not produced in the region, really. So there's a severe shortage of fertilizer. And so all of the fertilizer in the industrial plantations is being imported. And so there are often delays in supply and everything else, meaning that they're not being as regularly applied as what they are in Southeast Asia. And basically in any sort of locally produced oil palm, they just don't have access to fertilizer at all. It's just too expensive. The goal basically of the large scale company is basically to mimic Southeast Asian management practices as much as possible. Yeah.
Okay, thank you.
For sure. Thanks so much.
Thank you. Do we have any further questions?
I have a very low volume from you, Abigail, I think. But,
I'm really sorry. This is...
so don't worry. I think you give me a chance to ask a question. So as a plant reproduction biologist, I'm really curious about, is anything known about why those palm trees after 20, 30 years become less productive? Is that due to the number of fruits they produce, the amount of oil per fruit? Is it something to do with the density by which these palms are being grown in a monoculture? Because you also mentioned that in the wild, they get much older and so.
So the actual yield stuff is a bit outside my remit, but what I do know is, so the reason why they're replanting is based on yields. So it's basically, it's a metric of oil. It's not, say, the, I don't know, the number of fruits that are produced or something like that. I don't know if it's just a matter of them growing older. Sometimes it might be a prolonged impact of disease. For instance, like when I sample in like the older plantations, there does tend to be like the occasional palm that's clearly been taken out by some sort of disease. So in Southeast Asia, that would be like Ganoderma, like this fungal disease predominantly, or being attacked by rhinoceros beetles, which is the major pest. I don't think there's any indication that's because of planting density. So these industrial plantations plant with their palms 8 meters apart, and that's been extensively studied to have been determined basically as the optimal planting density. This isn't quite something that you've asked, but if it's helpful though, is that in terms of the industrial yields versus the yields of the wild growing palms in West Africa, the industrial yields are much, much, much higher. And that's largely attributed both towards the chemical input being put in, but also the variety of the palms. So they've all been bred to be these super palms, essentially, that just, they're shorter, they have higher yields. They've been designed in a lab. Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Do we have any further, Alison, and then?
Thank you. Great talk, Michael. Just a naive question about flowering. How long does it take to flower? You're looking at very early replantations of all palm trees. And I just wondered whether, you know, the number of insects, I presume, I know you presented your spider information. You mentioned you didn't present, I don't think, the other species that you were monitoring did decrease. There was a decrease in the once they've been replanted, but just wondered, were you looking at specific species? I mean, obviously pollinators, if the flowers aren't there and the nectar's not there, then they're not going to be around, and it's going to take time to establish those. And maybe the spiders are just good at taking anything that flies in rather than allowing like a natural enemy system where you have predators that will have to, pests that have to build up before the natural sort of ecosystem sort of arises. You hit that. Was it the case? I mean, how long do they take to flower?
Yeah, so they reach, that's not a naive question at all. It's a really good question. So they reach maturity at about 3 years. So that's going to be whenever they start to flower and stuff as well, and fruit and everything. And in Southeast Asia, there's been a weevil that's been introduced from West Africa. That's basically the primary pollinator. So for the longest time, people said it was the sole pollinator. There's been some studies now to indicate there's probably other insects that contribute in some small way, but it's the main pollinator though of oil palm. And then you see these weevils all over the inflorescences whenever they're flowering. And so I personally haven't studied the counts of these weevils, but a master's student in our research group has been studying them. And hopefully we'll have findings to share on those soon to show how these vary across the oil palm life cycle. Yeah, but you're right, though, there would be basically a tank right after replanting in these localized areas of replanting. And the industrial plantations have thought about this. So they replant basically in a staggered matrix so that they are always have an area of mature plantation, with the idea being that hopefully it doesn't lead to large scale decimation of the ecosystem, that basically things can move in and out across the matrix. Thanks.
Thank you very much. Emmeline, I think you had a question.
Yes. So I was wondering if you knew anything about sort of the quality results and thinking in the market. I mean, do palm oil producers care at all about sort of grades and what their product is, or is it just pure volume? And do you see a difference, or have people studied like a difference in quality or how you can use the palm oil based on different practices?
Yeah, so do you mean in terms of like its nutritional value?
Or not even just sort of like the percentage of oil content, all this thing. I'm thinking other crops, obviously. So wine is the biggest example, sort of when they add their different agriculture products that some people claim improve the quality of wine, or in broader agriculture, like organic versus non-organic, that kind of thing. Granted, obviously that's mediated by direct consumers being like, I want to consume this particular product. I believe it's better. And obviously palm oil is kind of a secondary. But I don't know if there's like, it changes the chemistry in some way, just sort of if you can produce different types of palm oil with different practices in the vineyard. Palm oil plantation.
A vineyard sounds much more glamorous for it. Yeah. I like that wording. Well, so at like a really broad level, so palm oil that you see in the supermarket has gone through like a refining process. And if you're in Southeast Asia and you're buying palm oil, like at the corner store as well, likely, or at least in Indonesia, you're going to be buying refined palm oil as well. So it has like that really nice golden color and everything. In West Africa, that tends not to have happened so much. So you'll get unrefined palm oil, which is totally different in color. So it's like more of a blood red. People will not produce it by sending it off to a mill because there aren't very many mills in Liberia, at least. And so it hasn't gone through like this processing. It's much more, I guess, base. Actually, at Medan in Cambridge, you can buy unrefined palm oil as well. But yeah, so that's like at a very base level. In terms of what the producers care about, so there is genuine interest within the oil palm industry, I found, in terms of wanting to increase sustainability. And I mean, I think that that's in part a PR thing, of course. I think there are also genuinely people who would like to still, like, they believe in the science of increasing yields as well, through mitigating environmental impacts. And I mean, that's shown, if nothing else, by like these large scale R&D hubs trying to improve the sustainability of the industry. There are a number of different like sort of sustainability certification schemes now as well to try and actually drive more sustainable management from a consumer perspective. So basically paying price premiums on sustainable palm oil that adhere to a number of different growth practices. So the RSPO is the most famous from amongst those. But I don't have any reason to suspect that why the chemistry of that oil would be any different from the chemistry of unsustainable palm oil. I think it's just more in terms of the growth practices.
Cool.
Thanks.
Thank you very much. Pablo, you have a question.
Thanks, Abigail. Thanks for bringing up the issue of the pollinators. That actually just remind me that that's something that has baffled me for many years now. It's like, how does it work in these plantations, like in the industrial ones, like in Southeast Asia, where they apply so much insecticides, and they still manage to have these weevils being there pollinating, which they had to introduce from Africa, as far as I recall. So where are these weevil populations surviving through the demise, I would say, of the insecticide application? Are the populations just moving within plantations, avoiding bits where the insecticide is being applied, or do you know anything about it?
Yeah, so I could tell you about the plantations that I've worked in. So in those plantations, actually, there's not, and this is my understanding of standard Sinarmas practices as well. So Sinarmas being the large Indonesian company that grows oil, is that they actually aren't constantly applying insecticides. So what happens is that they have standard monitoring of pest outbreaks across their plantations that they do through visually inspecting caterpillar abundances on the palm fronds. And basically, whenever they see that there's been an outbreak of caterpillars, they go in and they fog with like kill on contact insecticides. But that's like an isolated event, basically. So my guess would be then is that even once that kills off the weevils, is that basically they just move in from an adjacent area that hasn't been as much affected. Yeah. Thanks.
And thank you very much.